Bye-bye, bye-bye, bye-bye. Hey, do badders, welcome to Bad Boy Running. This episode we've decided to put out because Harder Skeezy, as you know, has been incredible in breaking the, well, being the first person to run the length of Africa from the south to the north. And we interviewed him a couple of years back where we not only spoke about some of his incredible running feats, where he set the world record for pulling a car, we also spoke about some of his other adventures, such as being in a box, buried in a box for 7 days straight. Unbelievable. So you really get a sense of his personality, his spirit, and his sense of adventure that have clearly gone into this incredible feat he's done in Africa. So we thought we'd reissue this to give you the chance to discover more about him. And if there are any other episodes you'd like us to promote in the future, let us know. Take it away, Nick.
They're bad, they're boys, and occasionally they talk about running. Yes, it's the Bad Boy Running Podcast with your hosts, Jody Rainsford and David Heller. Come back. Baby, come back.
Bye, 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 bye. I must admit I was a clown to be messing around, but that doesn't mean that you have to leave town.
So, do badders. This next guest, the name alone is enough to get someone on the podcast. But friend of the show, Chris Miller, he'd been listening to someone else's podcast and said, "You've just got to get this guy on." I went on YouTube, watched a really good interview with him. Love the fact he's beaten the record of a car puller who's been on the podcast. Love the fact he works with the running charity. But more than anything, I just love the fact that he's got the audacity to call himself Hardest Geezer. So welcome to the podcast, Hardest Geezer. Yay!
Thanks for having me on, guys.
It's got to be like that. For that name, it's got to be a proper like, wee!
Wee!
Are you,
I mean,
are you actually
is it? Is it now?
But are you actually that person? Or is it one of those situations where you've been given this moniker and all of a sudden you have to live up to it, but you're a completely different person from that, and you're feeling totally exhausted. You're going around going, and at the end of every day you're going, oh, I'm exhausted from being this character.
Put on Cinderella and...
yeah, I guess it's almost a bit of a caricature at this point. But it started as more of a laugh, and then I kind of ran with it, and it's just kind of stuck. So we're here with it now, and I quite enjoy it, to be honest. I think it's funny. So,
how many times in your life have you told the story of why you've got the name Hardest Geezer?
Do you know what? Not that many. It's actually not happened too frequently. People, I think, have assumed that from my like endurance achievements, then that's kind of how I've got the name. But it actually started before that. I can tell the story if you want.
Yeah,
I mean, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean...
yeah. So initially, it sort of started with a few of us lads went over to a festival in Spain, and we got ourselves a bit of a reputation in the camp. And that's when the name first started getting bandied around by people, but it was more of a collective.
What was the reputation for? how did you? You can't just say I got a reputation in a music festival.
Wait,
that's quite a hard thing to do.
Wait a minute. Is it ironic? Are you actually, or is it being used in an ironic sense?
It's a bit ironic. It's a bit ironic, but I guess I half live up to it as well. So it's kind of semi a joke, but also like fuck it as well. Like, yeah. So that's how it kind of the Hardest Geezer first sort of got said. And then basically a couple of months later, me and my mate decided to have a boxing match for the title of Hardest Geezer. So yeah,
we skipped over
the cowboy job.
What was the original incident that got you the name?
You're rushing
over this. It's like, what was it?
the original incident, I guess, was I had some gaffer tape at this festival, and I was like 20 or 21 or something at the time, and I ended up I was just gaffer taping everything, and then the security had enough of us, and then I ended up gaffer taping running around the security, and I gaffer taped him up, and then I got chased chase through the festival, but I'm a runner, so he didn't have no chance. So I was so weaving
he was
in
still
and
taped.
Out. Yeah,
and he was still taped chasing you.
Yeah. So it was good stuff, really. And then since then, it sort of, that's when it first sort of came about. And then, yeah, the boxing match was to decide the official title.
But you were never thrown out of the festival. You weren't, like, nothing.
Nah.
They didn't never got you.
No, they never caught me, I'm pretty recognisable bloke as well, so I did well to, to hide from that.
Wow. I mean, that's a better story than I heard on any other podcast I've ever listened to. And so then with this boxing fight then, how hard was your opponent?
Well, I mean, he's a typical geezer. He loves a beer, and he wasn't the fittest guy in the world. But, you know, that's what you've got to be watching in front of us. Yeah, exactly. So we went down the park, we set up a few ropes. Got my mate to live stream it,
we
smashed lungs out of each other, and I won by TKO in the second round. It's just from near where we live in Worthing, and the police ended up coming actually as well. Yeah.
Were the ropes gaffer tape perchance? Did you get stuck on them? Have you? was that how was you got him? He just got
rope from D&Q, I think it was. Proper cowboy operation.
See, the thing is, this all sounds like kind of crazy. But then, as soon as you say Worthing, all of this makes sense. It all completely makes sense.
Oh, it's a boring place. We've got to make some fun around here. You know what I mean?
and at the time, were you given? Oh, well, talk us through that knockout for one. Was that just a clean?
Yeah, I've still got the video of it. It was the first one was a nice little right. He was coming onto it, like it was right, and he ate that like a champ. But so he got back up after that, carried on for a bit, and then I hit him with another right straight down the pipe, and that was him done. Unfortunately for Big Haz White.
What park did this take place in?
I can't even remember what park it's called. It's just a little park in Worthing.
Skate park. Yeah, and what's that like, fighting a friend, when you're at, like, knocking out a friend is something that I don't think many of us have imagined.
Yeah, well, it's all fun and games, really. There's no malice in it at all. So it's just, you know, Both of us up for a little ding dong, no harm done. Shake hands again. We both went for a night out after. No dramas. It's just a bit of fun, really.
And did you receive a belt or some kind of?
We did have a £300 belt on it though, so I did get £300 out of it. So I'd rather that than a belt anyway.
And how was that spent?
Probably on that night out, to be honest with you.
And what age were you then? When did you officially become the hardest
geezer? I think that was about 20, maybe 21, something like that. And then that was the officially crowned hardest geezer moment. I bragged about it forever. And, you know,
and
now,
how much,
now here
how
we
much
are.
Of it, like, how much of it is... Like, because I'm known as Princess by a lot of my friends, and they will introduce me to people as Princess, and at times I've been like, I'm Princess, but if I walked in to meet a friend of a friend, I wouldn't be like, hey, I'm Princess, unless I knew they knew I was Princess.
Yeah.
Like, how much is hardest geezer?
Although in a lot of pubs when you walk in, they do go, look at this Princess. So
especially in Worthing, actually. Especially in Worthing.
Wow. Nice.
And
nice.
And so, like, how strongly, like, what, how many of your friendship group know you as hardest geezer? And how often would you kind of be known as hardest geezer amongst that, a kind of wider next step outside your friendship circle?
Yeah, so my friends don't call me Heise Geezer unless they want me to do something stupid, like down my drink, or like do some extravagant stunt that they think would be funny. Then I'm Hardest Geezer, but every other time I'm just Russ, and then I guess I'm Hardest Geezer to most people that ever see me on the street or anything like that. And then I'm Hardest Geezer, but now I'm Russ. I introduce myself as Russ to everyone that I meet, really.
So you've not had a job interview where you've kind of turned up top of the CV, Hardest Geezer?
Nah.
Because the Hardest Geezer CV would be something you'd want to read, right? You'd want it better be a deep CV.
It would be impressive, but I think maybe people might think I'm a bit egotistical, which isn't all, which isn't the best foot forward.
No, what about Hardest Geezer comes across as egotistical?
And do people, because I've had friends who are quite tall and you know physically imposing, and they found on nights out that sometimes gets them into trouble just because people almost seek them out to challenge themselves, to try and wind them up. Do you ever find that is a situation of your name where people try and challenge you, or try and compete, or try and take you on?
Especially
not really, to be honest. I've actually not really. It's been, everyone's I've met has always been pretty respectful, to be fair. So, I don't think I've really had much of that, fortunately.
So when did you start doing kind of running challenges then?
So the first big one I did was Asia to London in 2019. And that sort of spawned after I got really into running probably like a couple of years before that. And that was just inspired from traveling around the world. And I met an Italian guy who'd been cycling for 6 years, just carrying stuff on his bike, camping out every night. And I just thought it was unreal. And I thought that this Asia to London challenge would bring a bit more excitement to running. I think sometimes it can get a little bit dull, and it needs a bit of excitement injected into it. So that's kind of what spawned the idea. But I really had no clue what I was doing, to be honest with you. Like, literally none. I just rocked up in Istanbul.
Because prior to that, what was running to you in terms of how you were, like, type of runs, how often, where, prior to that?
I was serious. I was seriously into my running. By that point, I trained a lot. I did sort of about 250 kilometers a week for quite a few months in the build-up.
Oh, wow.
To Asia to London, yeah. So I did really take it seriously. But running to me at that point was... it was quite euphoric in the way that it really forced me to. It really broke down like complex problems in the way that running just faces you with a problem straight up that you're exhausted and you want to stop, and it made me find ways to overcome that with my mind, and then I could start applying that to other areas of my life. So running's like a huge part of who I am today, and it was such an important step for me at that time in my life to find running was so massive. I'm like, I'll forever.
And why were you going through kind of personal trauma and turmoil at the time then?
I was very much like a part of that lad culture. Like, I went out drinking a lot, gambled quite a lot, and I had little purpose in my life. I was really struggling to find any meaning to sort of be here. Like, what was the point? And running really installed a lot of those traits that I hold really close now, like motivation, gave me more confidence. Made me more resilient. So it was my savior in a lot of ways.
And when you then, because you mentioned you're doing kind of 250k a week, was that just based off your own instincts, or was there someone you were following, or did you have a set plan that you were kind of thinking you needed to stick to?
I didn't have like a coach. I didn't have anyone really. It was purely off my own back. I just, when I set myself the target of this challenge, I wanted to run from Asia to London, and I didn't know how long it was going to take, but I wanted to run a marathon every day whilst I was doing it. I knew that the closer I could get to running a marathon a day in training, the less likely it would be that my body would let me down. And that's what all I was really worried about, because I felt so fired up mentally at the time. I knew that I could hang in there and just dog it out with my mind, but I didn't want to get injuries, or, you know, find that my body was just giving up on me during the run. So that's why I took it so seriously and decided to up my mileage massively in order for my body to cope.
And did you have any issues with that? How did your body respond?
I did. Initially, I had a few like foot problems, but every time I sort of ran into a problem, I just like took it back a little bit and then went again when it felt okay. And, you know, I've been so lucky with injuries I've had. I've never been injured from running. The biggest injury I've ever had was an Achilles problem last year, and that was from other sports. So, yeah, I'm incredibly lucky to not suffer with, you know, being injury prone. And I'll put that down to a lot now. Yoga has helped me massively in keeping me loose. I was finding that my Achilles was because I was so tight everywhere else in my legs, and I wasn't stretching out properly. And yeah, so doing that now, I just feel like almost unbreakable.
That's quite a big claim.
Yeah, it is a big claim. So, I might eat my words on that.
Yeah, exactly.
So then the trip from Turkey, then why did you decide that that was the route for you?
I saw that it had never been done, and that sort of gave it a prestige that I thought was really exciting and cool. And also it timed perfectly, because it was during the summer, so the climate in that area of the world was like perfect timing. And I've been traveling for quite a long time, and I thought, you know, if I'm gonna go back home, then I might as well do it running from another continent. Like, that'd be pretty cool. So that was kind of the deciding factors into why I decided to go for it.
And had you mapped your route in advance?
Nah. I literally just Google Mapsed it. So I just rolled up in Istanbul and pressed London and just followed the route. And that was kind of it, really. There's no real, like...
So then... And yeah. I mean, does that work? Does that work?
Well, it worked,
that,
yeah,
the strategy?
Yeah. It did work. The only problem I had was... I couldn't go to. I got to the top of Bulgaria, and it was trying to send me into Romania, but I had to cross this massive river, which was an issue. So I ended up diverting and going through Serbia. But and then there was other times where it would lead me through some really horrid paths, like through forests and like through mountains and that sort of thing. But it got me there in one piece, so I'm not going to slate it too much. It did do the job eventually.
And what other preparation did you do then, like kind of logistics and kit and things like that?
I literally just... basically, everything was based off... I just visualised really intensely the run and all the problems that I might encounter, and then I based my kit off that. So there was no real like deep dive analysis into what I might need. I kind of just broke things down really simply. Like, I need shelter, I need water, I need food. Ideally, I would like to keep my phone charged as much as I can, and it would probably be quite nice to like wash every now and again and like be warm. So that, like, those are kind of the essentials to living, really. So you know, like I just kind of based it off that. I wasn't really worried about anything else. And then my kind of mindset was just to build myself into a place where I'd be comfortable rolling with whatever punches the run decided to throw at me, instead of trying to worry about planning each specific detail, because inevitably it's all going to go Pete Tong, and then what are you going to do? So I thought it was more important to build a mindset that was, you know, on top instead of planning.
Because it's easy to say you want to have food, but what does that actually translate into to what you're taking, and kind of how much are you planning out just a certain number of days? Are you ensuring you've already always got a certain type of nutrition, or how do you assess that, how much you can carry, and what were you carrying, like one big bag, or were you pushing something?
So I had a camelback, really small. I can't remember how many liters it was, but it didn't fit much in it at all. And I looked at Europe and I thought, well, Europe's a pretty populated place, eh? So there's not going to be very many times where I've run 26 miles in Europe and don't come across something. So I was kind of just rolling with whatever I stopped across, then I would get food from there. And a lot of the time it ended up being petrol stations. So, you know, nutritional value is low. I ended up eating peanuts and ice cream an awful lot because it was so dense in calories. But I trained for that. I did a lot of fasting, a lot of intermittent fasting in the build-up, because I knew that there would be, you know, stretches of quite a few hours or days potentially where I wasn't going to eat. So I did my training whilst I was intermittent fasting, and you know, like I said before, like I just prepared for that scenario.
And were you doing knocking on doors as well and things along those?
Yeah, lines? Did a lot of that. And that, do you know what? There were some really helpful people out there that went the extra mile for me when they had absolutely no reason to. Like, cook me dinner, let me stay at their place, let me charge my phone in their house. Like, offer to drive me when I had to, it was heartbreaking to turn it down every time I had to. It was like so inspiring to be treated so well by so many people that had no
who were the,
I wasn't.
Who were the friendliest? Means, like, and who? Crazy. Yeah, so who were the friendliest and who were the least friendly as a nation?
Okay. that's a good one. I would say I came across the most friendly people in Bulgaria, but that whole region was really friendly. So Turkey, Bulgaria and Serbia were all super nice to me. Like, there was nice people in every country, so I don't want to throw too much hate out there. But maybe this was just a cultural football based thing. I found people in Germany to be quite rude. And, you know, I'm not really sure why that was. Maybe it was just the way they speak. They could be telling me that they love me and they think I'm beautiful, but the way they say it in that language just sounds like they're trying to fight me.
And how do people typically react then? Did you almost end up having a sales speech of what you'd say when you knock on the door and kind of go through your patter? Or?
Not really, because they couldn't really understand. No one really spoke English. It was really difficult. I just kind of made myself look as vulnerable as possible and pleaded for any help that I could get.
How did that look?
And how, just Google
what,
translated.
What's your most vulnerable face?
I didn't have
Come
to
on,
put it.
Let's see what happens.
Probably just a bit of like looking like I'm really struggling, like I'm out of breath, I'm sweating. But I didn't have to do much of it because my hair was growing out. I was all sunburned. Like, you could tell I'd been through the ringer, so I didn't have to do all that much. So yeah, I would just knock on doors and get my Google Translate ready and try and explain. Sometimes you get shut down, but most of the time people were super accommodating and they'd help me wherever they could.
So what's your strategy then to do a marathon a day?
Yeah. What was my strategy?
Was that your approach? Were you looking to try and kind of do a marathon a day and then refuel and sleep?
That was the game plan, yeah. I ended up breaking it down quite a lot because bashing it all out in one go was really intense and like I'd fatigue quite badly. But I sort of broke it down into like hour stints a lot of the time. Just run for an hour, chill for a bit, then go again, that sort of thing.
And what were you doing with your time when you weren't running typically?
To be honest, the running was like only a small part of the challenge because I was, I was so focused on looking on the map to see where I could get food, looking to see where I'd be able to charge my phone, looking to see where there was water that I could like wash my clothes in or wash myself in. Looking to see what like the terrain coming up was like. There was so much going on. And then, you'd get to these, I'd finish my running and I'd look for somewhere to sleep for the night and it would often be in like a little forest or something. And then I'd settle down and then I'd be thinking about what sort of animals are around here locally, what sort of people are around here, how far away are they? Like all these kind of things, there was just so much to think about that I was constantly on the go. Like I barely even got to sleep that much. It was just never ending cycle of thinking.
Did you have any run-ins with any animals then?
There was a few. There was one night in Bulgaria where I hanged my hammock to sleep for the night and police came and they were like, "What are you doing?" And I try to sort of explain, and they were like, "No, you cannot stay here. There's wolves everywhere." And I was like, "Oh god!" But I was so exhausted. I honestly didn't care. I was just like, "I just want to sleep here, like right now. I just want to sleep." And they were like, "No, you have to move on." They offered to give me a lift, but I said, "Look, I can't get in your car. It's cheating." So I literally walked on for about one more kilometer, found some more trees in a farm, and just went, "Yeah, this will do." And I was so exhausted, I just put my hammock up, tried to go to sleep, and then sporadically throughout the night, I was just getting woken up to the sound of wolves howling, which felt like a matter of minutes away. And I was so deluded at the time that I was just like, I don't care. And secondly, if any of these wolves want it, they can get it. Like, I will give it out. So that was kind of the mindset at the time. It would have been interesting to see how that played out. I might not be here if they decided that I was dinner. But that was probably the hairiest moment.
Put 300 quid on it, there was lots and maybe of times you're snakes, maybe you're motivated.
Yeah, that was the main
and
one.
Actually, we've never really talked about, because we've had a lot of people in the past who've done self-supported or running across countries and things, but phone charging is the one thing that we've never really thought about, because actually it's a lot easier to buy food than it is to charge a phone. And even when you buy food, that takes, 2-3 minutes, whereas charging a phone, depending on your phone, can take 90 minutes to 4 hours. Have you got any advice on where you do it and were people quite receptive for you just plugging in?
Most of the time people were fine about it. There was a few times where people thought it was really rude, and I did ask, if I was somewhere, I'd ask if I could charge my phone, and everyone was fine. But it is difficult. It is just, and it's so time consuming, because you might be, I might have been like 20K into my run, and then this is the only building that I can stop at to charge my phone for the day. So now I've got to take 3-4 hours out of my day just to get my phone charged, it is a bit of a nightmare. Mm. But I think tech might move on in the next few years and kind of make that less of an issue, especially with like solar panels. Maybe there might be some like, someone should come up with some like wearable solar panel tech that you could charge it with. The market's a bit niche, but I'd be all over it.
Like a tech back.
Yeah,
solar back, and it would.
Yeah.
And did you have a charge pack as well, or were you?
I did have a battery pack, but you know those things only last for so long because the batteries in them are normally pretty cheap, nasty stuff. So they were. I went through quite a few power banks, but yeah, it was difficult when my phone died. It was a bit of a nightmare, to be honest, because that was my route as well. So if my phone died, I'd try and memorize the route as much as I could before it died, and then I'd just follow the sun as well. But yeah, so it wasn't the easiest thing, keeping your phone charged.
And what did you find the hardest about the challenge?
I would say like one of the hardest parts about that challenge was like doing it by myself, because it gets very isolating and lonely. Like especially when you're in countries where people you can't even like really chat to anyone because they don't speak the same language as you. That did become, you know, quite hard, especially when I was so mentally and emotionally exhausted every day. There was like, it felt like I had no kind of support network in that sense. So that was probably, I would say, looking back, the hardest part.
Had you experienced that before?
Yeah, but not in like such an obvious way. Like there was no one really could help me there. Do you know what I mean? It was out there by yourself, slogging out every day, and it's just grit your teeth and get through it, or don't. And that was kind of the two options I had.
And does that change kind of how you interact with people, even if you know they can't speak English? Are you desperate just to spend time with someone, even if you're not necessarily having a conversation?
I mean, I was pretty focused, and I was trying not to really like think in that way. It's more of like a hindsight thing, but it was so nice to have those moments with people in the countries where they did help me. Like to share those moments was so motivating and energizing. It was really, really good.
And what would you say was your lowest moment during the trip?
There was several moments that were pretty low. I would say that there was a time when I ended up bumping into a prostitute in Hungary, and that whole saga left me in pretty dire straits, because I finished my marathon the day and I ended up in this town, and I was knackered. I went out for dinner and I found a campsite in the town. I thought, hallelujah, I've got somewhere to shower tonight and charge my phone. And as I'm walking to the campsite, this woman starts following me, chatting Hungarian, or I'm not sure what language, I presume Hungarian, and insists on taking me to the campsite. And I tell her, look, like, no, girl, I'm done for the day, like, just leave me alone. But she follows me all the way there, and then when I get to the campsite, they turn me away, presumably because they thought I was trying to bring one of the local prostitutes into the campsite. And that whole saga, she ended up following me after that. Then she was fuming when I refused to give her any money. She was fuming when I wouldn't engage in any sexual activity with her, and she called someone I can only presume was a pimp shouting down the phone. And that's when I knew that things were getting serious and I needed to make some sharp moves out of there. And then, so I've sprinted off to the motorway and camped by the side of the motorway for the night. And the next morning, I've probably slept for like an hour. My phone's dead. My feet are absolutely battered. And I haven't washed. I feel disgusting. I have no idea where I'm going. And I wake up, pack my stuff up. And first off, I was just grateful that I'm not dead. And then I walk into this public bathroom, splash some water all over my face, look in this like cracked mirror, there's smashed bits of dirt everywhere, glass on the floor. And, you know, I really thought then, like, this is the pits. Do you know what I mean? You have really done it this time, Russ. But overcoming the marathon that day was so empowering. It made me feel like I was invincible and I had no limitations. So I completed the marathon that day. I really had to dig in. Every part of my body was hurting. But when I did it, I got to a petrol station where the guy got me a beer, gave me a shower, and that was halfway mark of the journey. And from then on, I was just like, I was set. I was like, there's no way anyone can tell me a thing. I am kicking the hinges off this challenge, and that's that.
And what was your motivation in those dark points? What were you reaching for?
I mean, there was lots of moments where your body is screaming at you to quit. And I think a lot of it for me was I felt like I had something to prove, not just to myself, but to everyone that had ever doubted me, basically. And that was a real fire. I used that negativity and that bad energy that I was surrounded by and turned it into like a rocket fuel where I was just so determined to make something of myself. And that was just a huge motivating factor that lit a fire up my ass for the whole thing. Every time I thought, to be honest, I never thought about quitting, but anytime things got hard, I would, you know, I'd go there and be like, no, not today, like, we're getting through this.
And when you came back, those people who had doubted you and the naysayers, like how did they react to the challenge?
I mean, everyone was obviously super proud of me for doing it. So, you know, it's one of them where sometimes people, they doubt you when you say you're going to do it and then you do it and now they're really proud and it's great and all the rest of it. But yeah, I mean, I don't hold any grudges about that. It's all good.
And so when you then returns, where does that, because it sounded as if you were a little bit lost prior to the run, like what, and you've had this amazing high. And, yeah. And you're now confident, but it doesn't necessarily give you a direction because actually you've been doing something that is very hard to repeat. And actually you might not want to necessarily just continue doing that for the rest of your life. So did you have any, how did you figure what to do next?
The months after that were really hard because I found something that I was super passionate about and that I saw the potential for a career in, but I had absolutely no idea how to make that work. And to be honest, for probably about 2 years after that, I was trying to piece it together here and there, like how could I turn this into something? And again, it was something that people didn't really believe that you could, you know, have a career in that kind of thing. It's too extreme. It's too... how you're going to monetize it, all that sort of stuff. And I had to go through the rigmarole of working jobs that I didn't really like again. And, you know, I was really skint at the time, so I didn't really have a choice in that regard. Then I kind of tried for the next 2 years to turn this into something that could be a career. And now I'm sort of just about getting to the stage now where that's possible and it's happening, which is so exciting. And I'm absolutely buzzing for it. I can't wait to do loads more stuff that's way bigger and way more extreme than Asia to London. I was really lost again after the run, though. It was just such a, like you said, it was such a high, and then come back to reality again. It's just like, oh, Christ, like we're back here.
And do you think there was a chance that you would have just kind of receded and returned to life as it were before?
I think, you know, it was such a big thing that it was always going to stay with me in some sense. It was just a matter of time of figuring it out. And I kind of, you know, for a lot of people, I guess they figure out the business side of things and then they do the run, whereas I did it the other way around. I had no idea about making this a business, but I could do the challenges, and then I've kind of backwards it from there.
So when did the carpool fit into this? Because we interviewed, I mean, we know Ross, who set the record originally. Then we interviewed the I can't remember his name now, but the gentleman from Australia who'd gone out and managed to beat Ross Edgley's record. And that, so
yeah,
given that you'd almost become a specialist in traveling with a small bag, why did you think it made sense to do the complete opposite?
Well, you know, it's funny when, like you say, the complete opposite, but I really did not see it that way because, you know, I've mocked Ross Edgley a fair bit on social media before, but and I do respect him. It's more just jovial jokes that are trying to get a nibble off him, but he's a big guy. He's a massive guy, right? Like, he's jacked up. And I just looked at him and I thought, if you've got to fuel your shoulders and your biceps whilst you're pulling a car, your shoulders and your biceps are useless at this point. All legs, do you know what I mean? I just thought that's not that efficient. And I just thought, I bet I'm more efficient. I have the endurance in my legs already. And I thought, we'll go to the gym, we'll smack some weights about with my legs for a few months. And I bet you I could beat his time, and I did. So that was all the thinking was really behind that. But like I said, I do respect Ross and his swimming. I couldn't get near. But if he fancies a run, then he's dusted.
and when you say you went to the gym and for like a couple of months, like what? How much weight were you lifting, and how quickly were you putting on substantial amounts of weight during that time?
I did put on a fair amount of weight. I probably got up to about 76 kilos, which I'm normally sit around at like 68 to 70, and you know, sometimes even lower when I'm getting ready for a long run. But yeah, I didn't really focus on how much weight I was lifting. I was just really, really thought that I could do with strengthening up the legs for the challenge, just to make sure I don't get injured more than anything. But yeah, it's, you know, when you're looking at a 10-hour plus endurance event, it's purely endurance. It's not really about power. So it wasn't that big of a deal for me to go and put on loads of weight. Once you've got the car moving, it's not that, you know, it's actually not that hard.
Oh, interesting, because that's the thing. Most people know carpooling from things like the World's Strongest Man, where even getting the car moving seems to be more than half the battle. So how would you, if you is there a way you could explain just how hard or how achievable getting a car moving is with those harnesses? And is it something that most of us could do? Or
The thing is, with the world's strongest man, is I don't know the specifics of it, but I know they pull big vehicles for really short distances, and it's like a time thing, like basically a sprint. It's a test of power, like go and output as much as you can for 30 seconds or whatever, which is definitely a strong man event. But when you're pulling a car for a marathon, it's no longer a power-based event. It is, you gradually build speed up in the car over a few minutes, and there's no real, it's not like a sprint. You just edge it forward a little bit, and then, you know, apply more and more until you've got it rolling pretty good. But yeah, like, you know, everyone can push a car. If your car broke down and you have to push your car for a few, you could just easily do it, but it's not actually that. It sounds cool though, so.
You've not seen David do anything like that. They don't.
Anything strength-based, true. I can't even push my body off the ground, let alone push a car.
I don't know how the thing moves anyway. Like, what?
And how, in terms of your body composition and like the muscles that you use, because were you having to almost adjust massively the balance of how you use your legs and muscles when you run?
I honestly I didn't overcomplicate it that much. It was quite strenuous for all parts of the legs, but I just kind of carried on with my normal running routine and just added strength training to it more intensely, and that was it. I didn't deep the science behind it too much. I had a theory that I was more efficient than a big huge guy trying to pull a car for 42 kilometers, and that was the basis for my whole theory. I've got to do this and I've got to do that, and what about this? Just go and give it a bash and see what happens.
And what are the rules of the car?
So the rules for the car is, I think it has to be more than 700 kilos. And I think that's about it, to be fair.
And what, did it have a full tank of petrol?
Did you choose any particular?
Did it have a full tank? Because I think we'll be
I did have a driver. Yeah, some big mates in there. Boys, I was like, boys, trim up, mate.
Do they weigh the car with people in then?
Nah. So you just have the official weight of the car, and then I had to have a driver because I was doing it on the promenade in Worthing, which meant that I had to turn the car around 42 times because it was just a 1 kilometer stretch. So we had to have someone steering in there. But that was that.
And do things like winds, can you really feel it in one direction versus the other? Right? Are there strategies you'd change if you were to do it again?
If I was to do it again, I would try and get a circular loop that was completely flat and pick the least windy day of the year to do it. But, you know, these are factors you can't always control. The hardest part about the way I did it is that it was a 1 kilometer stretch, so I had to restart the momentum 42 times, which was a bit annoying. But it was okay.
Interesting. You couldn't do the turn in a way that the momentum would carry.
Go all the way and then unplug the harness, replug it to the front or the back, and then start again.
Wow. And where was it starting to hurt?
I started flying. So I thought, I'm going to set the pace really fast and just see how long I can hold it. it started getting pretty painful from about 30k onwards, similar to like a normal marathon, how you kind of hit that wall, and then that last 10k, 6 miles is pretty brutal. It was pretty similar to that, really.
Although I guess the difference is that 10k when you're doing 10 hours is a quarter of that. It's still,
yeah, you know, it's like the, 2.5 hours
the
stretch,
time
yeah.
of some people's marathons.
Yeah.
And how would you feel?
So I carved up. I had some gels. I had some sugary sweets. I had my caffeine. And, you know, that kind of just buzzed me through.
And do you think it's like a record that people will... Do you think the record will last for a while? Because I can't imagine... imagine people want to take on people like Ross's record looking at Ross.
Yeah. But
there aren't many runners who I think would want to do that as a challenge.
Mm. Someone could beat it pretty... If, you know, a pretty high-end athlete could come and beat it, I think. And I think I could beat it now. So if someone does go and beat it, then I would be pretty tempted to give it another go, to be fair. Because I think I've got more in the tank there. But, yeah, maybe. I wouldn't be that surprised if someone came along and tried to do it.
And do you think they'd be a, super fast runner or more of a kind of powerful ultra runner, or what type of athlete do you think would be
it would be suited to a stronger, more well-built ultra marathon athlete. I think the trouble that the speedy, like whip it 5k 10k guys would have is that they'd be too slender and their muscles would maybe give out, or even if it's not their muscles, like the stability wouldn't be there the same way. So I could see like an ultra guy, or maybe like a CrossFit athlete, maybe someone that was a bit hybridy. They could give it a good
go. Or someone like an obstacle racer potentially, because obstacle racer's got so much leg strength. John Album, if you're listening, we want you to give it a try. And so and was that your second task then, your kind of second big one?
That was the next thing after the Asia run.
And how did what was the response like in terms of your growth, in terms of how you viewed yourself and how you felt about it afterwards? Did you get the same low?
In my eyes, it wasn't as big as Asia to London. It was more just like I thought, good one to tick off that and went for it. So it was more of a, like, let's just keep this party rolling over a huge, like, I'm working towards this and it's going to be, like, amazing sort of thing.
And was doing it in Worthing, did that help?
Yeah, it was cool to do it in Worthing. I had loads of support, people that came down to watch, which was really sick. That was awesome, actually.
And then, so I can't remember. So was that your last challenge then, or have you?
No, well, so I did. Pipeline now. I did Buried Alive shortly after that.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
So yeah, tell us about Buried Alive then, because that's a very different undertaking.
Yeah, totally
good pun, no pun intended. But when did you decide to go down that route?
So that was shortly after the Buried Alive. I thought that would be a cool one to diversify into. It was still kind of Corona times as well, so there was no real option of a cross-continental run again for a while. So I thought, this won't be a cool one. It was the first major thing that David Blaine did back in like 1999. I think he did Buried Alive for a week. And I just, you know, I see myself as like an endurance athlete. So more than like specifically a running athlete. So it was just something that I wanted to like diversify into and test out. And, you know, it's completely different to the other things I've done in terms of everything else I did was all about how much can you do in this amount of time, and Buried Alive was all about how little can I do in that amount of time. And I thought it would be a great mental test and round me out more as a person as well, which it was great.
So what are the rules then? What's the actual challenge and what are the parameters?
So the rules were underground, in a box, no food, no stimulation, no mental stimulation, and yeah, that was it. You were only allowed water, basically.
So, and how big's the box then? And is there then a tube to the surface, and do you have lights?
Yeah. Yeah, so there was, I was in a coffin, like a coffin without a lid, and then we put a box around the coffin. So I didn't have much room at all. I could probably go like this with my elbows and have like that much room to the side of me, and then I could sit up as well. And we designed it like that so that otherwise, if I couldn't sit up and turn around, then I'd get bed sores after a week, which we thought would probably be a bad idea. And also migraines in my head if I was constantly lying down. So that's why we did that. And then we had air tubes coming up. And then we had a light in there as well, because we live streamed the whole thing on YouTube. So people needed to see that I was actually there and I wasn't trying to, you know, that we weren't trying to do some kind of smoke and mirrors job on them.
And how did you prepare by doing long sessions similar?
Yes. Yeah, so I did I did a lot of meditation to prepare, which really helped me stay calm. And, you know, because the main thing with, I'm a very relaxed person in general, but the main thing I was concerned about is, I don't know if you can sort of like imagine in the middle of the night sometimes when you wake up from a sleep and you're kind of like a bit disorientated in terms of where you are and what's going on, blah, blah, blah. I was a little bit worried that in those moments, I wouldn't have complete control over my mind and it would go to places that I didn't want it to go. So meditating really helped me stay calm in any moment where I thought that I might lean towards panicking. So that was something I focused heavily on. And then the other thing was fasting, because I had to go a whole week without anything other than water. So I did a lot of... fasting is something I've done for years anyway, but I did a lot of 100-hour plus fast in the build-up.
And what, when you say meditation, what did that look like?
So for me, meditating, you can do it so many different ways. Like, it can be the more sort of traditional way of like sitting up, eyes closed, focus on your breathing through the nose, and blank your mind out of all thoughts. Or, now I meditate a lot during running. It's just, you know, it's just a really calm, relaxed state where I'm just really like zen and mindful, and that's what meditating is for me. So that's how I sort of practice it.
You don't repeat a mantra or similar, or
a lot of the time in the build up, I did like meditation with also like deprivation. So I wouldn't have my phone for a set amount of time, or I'd be fasting whilst I did it, or I'd be in a tight space, all these sorts of things to try and replicate what it would be like to be buried alive as much as possible. But, you know, now in my daily life, it's more obviously just for my benefit rather than to train.
And where does your mind tend to wander?
Honestly, like, I'm always thinking, so it's really hard to kind of switch off sometimes, which is why I find it so useful. I will just end up thinking about whatever's happening, whatever daily stresses you might have. I've got to chat to this person later. I've got this booked in for later. I've got a meeting here. I've got blah, X, Y, Z. And it's kind of all about just trying to clear those thoughts it doesn't have to be for long, maybe like 10 minutes. It really helps. Just like helping you feel calm, helping you feel relaxed, reducing your anxiety, all those sorts of things. That's what I find it really helpful for.
So did you have a concept of time or day or night while you were there?
Fortunately, yeah, because the live stream said on how many hours it had been going for, so I kind of had a rough idea of where I was at. That might have been, you know, an added little challenge in there if I had no idea. But I think my timing would be relatively okay, because I've done so much fasting, I could really feel at where my body was at what point.
Because does it change the challenge because your energy levels differ and your body's even breaking down different things?
So, you know, those first, like, I'd say, like, the first day was all like a novelty. It's all quite exciting, you doing your new challenge, blah, blah, blah. But then by the end of it, you know, you haven't eaten for a week, you're really kind of suffering. And it was, you know, those are the moments where you grow the most, though. I mean, if you're suffering so intense, it forces you into places where you have to overcome that with your mind. There was no other way I could overcome it. There was no distraction. There was no anything. I just had to sit in that coffin and suffer. And that's kind of what was so beautiful about the challenge. And always it really forced me to live in discomfort, which was so empowering.
And what was the discomfort and the suffering?
It's just you're starving. Your body is literally eating itself alive. So, you know, that's not that fun. But also, you know, like you haven't had anything to stimulate your head for a week. You're kind of crying out for some kind of entertainment, especially in this world now where we have access to, you know, instant entertainment for whenever we want, wherever we want, in whatever form we want it. And to have a week where there was just you in your head, you know, I'd be lying if I said there was points where I just felt like I needed a 10-minute distraction to watch, to hear someone else's voice, to see something else other than the four walls of this box.
And did you play any games or kind of sing songs?
Oh, I did a lot of singing. Yeah, loads of singing. I'm a terrible singer. 3 out of 10 for execution, but 10 out of 10 for effort. I did a lot of singing. I did a lot of maths, a lot of mental maths, just like my times tables, all that kind of jazz. A lot of counting, all the fingers. Yeah, got a bit loose with it.
And what happens toilet wise?
So I basically just pissed in the bottles that I drank. So I drank a bottle of water and then I would wee in that same bottle. And I thought I was going to need to go for a poo, but I didn't need a poo
for
the entire
week.
Yeah. Wow. I think it got to the stage after. So normally when I would do these fasts, my last poo would come about 20 hours after I ate, and then that would be it. But for this one, I think I just kind of held it for past that. And then once I've gone like 3 days without eating, my body's gone into starvation mode and gone like, we are not releasing anything. We are extracting as much new nutrients from this poo before we let it go, because it might be what we need to keep my body alive. So, yeah, I didn't go for a poo the entire week.
Because I had, like, just like the day before you go in, are you prepping your body for not eating, or are you eating as much as you can?
Oh, I'm eating.
Going in there with a mouthful of burger.
I'm eating all sorts. I'm eating everything I can see. The only trouble was, is sort of a few hours before, that's the time where you'd be thinking, right, I need to scram as much stuff as I can right now. But I was kind of like this weird little nervous excitement about challenge, so I had no appetite, which was just terrible timing. But so I didn't really eat that much actually directly before I went in, which was a bit annoying, but it made it through all right in the end.
And kind of how does that leave you when you, because the other races, you're craving this noise and things, but you've had stimulation, you've had, you know, crowds in the carpool, you've had the roads and cars and things. What was it like actually emerging to an audience, like a cheering crowd as such?
It was quite just like, I mean, when I got out, I couldn't even walk. My legs were just jelly. They were literally wobbling all over the place. And I had had my friend round and had a beer and a pizza. And, you know, that was kind of that. I ended up actually, I had a challenge to do with a YouTuber friend of mine the next day. So I was just straight back into the next thing after that. So it was quite all right, to be honest with you.
What was that challenge?
We went to the world's most remote pub in Scotland. It takes 3 days to get there via hiking, or you can get there by boat. But we decided to go there, climbing through the mountains for 3 days. And interesting choice, considering, you know, less than 24 hours before that, I could not even stand on my own two legs. We got there in the end.
And so you weren't left with any like major physical frailties, or?
Nah, I was actually sweet. I think if anything, fasts of that length, maybe slightly shorter, are actually really, really good for us to do. I think it flushes out your system, gets rid of the toxins, and you know, I haven't done a big fast like that for a while, but it's definitely something I'll probably try and do at least once a year, is a big, big long fast.
And can you just eat, or is it very measured how you reintegrate?
You're supposed to be very measured with it. I decided to come out and have a beer and a pizza, which was terrible decision making because my stomach was in bits. But you're supposed to be. You know, if I was doing it right, then I would eat maybe like a little bit of fruit and a few nuts, and then wait a few hours again and have like a small meal, and then gradually ease my stomach back into it. But I decided that I didn't care, and I was just going to hammer on Tom, go all in.
And interest, and now, you know, what did that first poo look like?
I'm trying to remember exactly how this went. It might have been the other way around to how I say it, but from what I remember, the first one was rock solid, like a couple nuggets kind of thing, and it was like really black.
A little diamond.
The blackest poo I've ever had. It was strange. And then I ate some food, and then shortly after, went for another one, and it was like extreme diarrhea.
Yeah. Interesting. And just, do you know, does your pee colour change during those 7 days?
It was very yellow. It was very yellow. And it did stink as well. But it was nothing to worry about. It wasn't coming out like red or anything.
So now then, because you mentioned you've now finally kind of feel a direction where you are able to make a living out of these kind of challenges. So what does that look like? What is that from sponsorship? Is that from media? Is that from TV shows? How have you managed to make it work?
So, I mean, I guess how I've managed to make it work at the moment is I've worked with the running charity and lead adventures for the young people in our programs. And fundraisers that want to support our cause, which is, I mean, I guess it's a job, but it doesn't really feel like a job to me. It's like the most fulfilling thing I've ever done. It's like I'm so proud to be part of. So that, I'm fortunate enough to get some money from that. And then I've also got a huge challenge lined up for the end of the year. I'm going to try and run the entire length of Africa from the most northern point to the most southern point. So we're getting sponsors and investment into that at the moment as well, which is looking good. So I'm really excited about that. We're going to be making loads of content for YouTube. We're going to try and get a little documentary at the end of it made up. We'll be doing some podcasts like yours as well. That's kind of the game plan for me, and we'll kind of see where it goes. I'm really excited about that one, though. It's going to be absolutely nuts.
Is that reliant on, because I know with North to South there's some issues, because in the middle part you've got Sudan, you've got Mali, there's quite a few countries that are problematic.
Yes.
Do you have a route selected that you know will be fine to go through, or is it going to be quite dependent on politics?
I do have a route. Whether it will be fine to go through is another question. Like you said, there is... So you're talking about the countries in the east there, like Somalia and Sudan, but we're going to go from the north in Tunisia, the most northern point, to the most southern point, which is South Africa. So we'll be going Tunisia, Algeria, Niger, Nigeria, Cameroon, Gabon, both the Congo countries, Namibia, Angola, and South Africa. So there is obviously, we've done the research, I've looked up online, and quite a few of them countries are, you know, recommended not to travel to from the government website. But take that with a pinch of salt. We've got a game plan. We're going to get fixers and all this kind of stuff to try and help us along. It's definitely going to be much more of a professional operation this time, like going to have a support team and that sort of stuff. It's definitely doable in terms of, you know, plenty of people have driven through those countries, people visit those countries. Mm. It's just preparing for it in the right way. And, you know, I think Africa gets a bad rap a lot of the time. You can get robbed, you can get stolen from, you can get attacked anywhere in the world, and it happens everywhere in the world, whether you're in England or Germany or Spain or Congo, anywhere. But, you know, I'm rolling through as someone that has no beef with anyone. I'm here to spread positive vibes at all times. Hopefully that gets reciprocated. I'm sure it will in most circumstances. Sometimes it won't, but, you know, that makes the story what it is as well. Do you know what I mean? So I have no complaints from me.
You're the hardest geezer, that's how you sort it out.
Exactly.
It's your fallback.
And one of the things I actually wanted to just discuss with you is your kind of time working in a prison, which I think would just seems a little bit out of context now. But given that you've mentioned the running charity, we've spoken to Alex before on the podcast about what they do for rehabilitation. From what you've done with people in the running charity, like, what would you bring or what would you change about the way prisoners are treated in the UK to try and rehabilitate them based on your experience within the running charity?
Yeah. So, you know, I think when I worked in the prison, it was during Corona time. So one thing was that the gym was not open in the prison. So there is a gym in prison that, you know, prisoners are allowed to go to for set times, a few times a week. But what I would say that the prison could really do with utilizing exercise and fitness as a tool to empower these guys and girls to find something within themselves, overcome challenges in a different way, and you know, done in the prison service at the moment, it's very much a get on with it kind of thing. And I think it is going to change. Hopefully it is. You can see like bits where they're trying to change it, and it's obviously a process. But I think from how we deal with people, the running charity, the prison service could do with a lot more compassion. And that trying to understand people's problems instead of just, you know, labeling them as bad people and kind of casting them away, trying to reintegrate them into society would be much more beneficial, I think.
And from your experience, do you get a sense that a lot of prisoners can be rehabilitated?
You know, they definitely can. It's not easy. I won't sit here and say, oh, like, it's so easy. A lot of these guys have such complex problems that need a lot of time invested in them to help them overcome it. And that resource is currently not there. And, you know, I get the argument from all sides. People say, like, we should be investing taxpayer money into, you know, education or various other different things. And, you know, why should we be investing in people that have done X, Y, Z, blah, blah, blah. I get that argument, but I think, you know, what I would like to see more is society being treated more fairly, instead of this kind of like the rich are getting richer and everyone at the top is getting on here and then there's people getting left behind. And I think that there needs to be more of an effort to bring these people up rather than just discarding them as, you know, whatever they want to label them.
Well, yeah, I couldn't agree more. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. And if people want to donate to kind of the running charity or to any of your future endeavours or to follow you, what's the best way for them to do that?
So the best way, if they want to come and get involved with anything that we're doing at the running charity, I actually run adventures where we take fundraisers on really cool trips like the Three Peaks, the Pilgrimage to the Pub, is another one we do. See the summit in Snowdonia. So people can literally come and book onto those adventures, and I'll take them there, and they fundraise for the running charity, so it all goes to a good cause. So that's how a great way they can get involved with the running charity. They can check out the website, speedrunningcharity.org. And then if they want to follow me, it's Hardest Geezer on any social media platform you can find.
Was that a statement or was that the is that a challenge? You're going to get Logan Wasserchops suddenly taking you on a boxing. Thanks so much for coming to the podcast and good luck with your attempt at running across Africa.
Thank you very brilliant. Much.
Thanks, Russ. That's great.
Nice one. Cheers, guys.
I was a clown to be messing around, but that doesn't mean that you have to leave town. Come back, yes, and give me one more try, cause a love like this should I never ever die. Come back. Fuck you, buddy.